No, no, ma'am. This is not a good idea.
Sorry, Goose, but it's time to buzz the tower.
And welcome to the second hour of the Danger Zone podcast, also known as Buzz the Tower, here at the SantaCruzVoice.com and KSCO.com. I am your host, Jim Two, and today is Friday, May Day, May 1st of 2026. Oh my God, I'm so old. I start things at 2019 instead of 20. Anyways, let's see here. Going through the stack of stuff, I guess, you know, the weird thing is, you know, I recorded my podcast last week on a Friday, you know, posted it, you know, and then hoping for a relatively slow weekend. And then, of course, we had the attempted assassination of Donald J. Trump. And what did we get? So where are we? Anyway, so, I think we have Cole Thomas, and I figure it's worth talking about a bit more. And let's see, here's a story, you know, right? Initially, everyone was like, oh, no, you can't discern his motives. And then he released a manifesto. So let's go over some of the things that he put on his manifesto. CNN.com, this is from April 27th, suspected shooter's social media posts show shift from video games to political rage. The suspect charged in White House correspondence in a shooting shared post comparing President Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler and encouraged others to critical of his presidency to purchase guns, according to a CNN review of two social media accounts that appear to belong to him. The accounts linked to 31-year-old Cole Thomas Allen, who appeared in court today on charges of attempting to assassinate Trump, shifted in recent years from posts about video games to angrier political messages. The postings also echo arguments in a message Allen allegedly sent to family members before the attack that laid out a plan to target Trump administration officials and expressed anger at their actions. Investigators believe that the posts, as well as information taken away from multiple electronic devices seized over the past few days, show Allen's animosity towards Trump and his administration, sources familiar with the investigation told CNN. Senior Justice Department official confirmed to CNN that Allen used an X account to handle C-Force 3000, an account that has been taken offline, but CNN reviewed more than 4,000 posts that are saved in the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. And CNN also reviewed more than 700 archive posts from now offline at coldforce.bsky.social account on the social media network Blue Sky. That account also appears to belong to Allen based on biographical details that it posted that matched Allen's life, as well as a similar username and a content post on the X account. In the message, Allen allegedly sent family members he signed off with the nickname Cold Force. On X, Allen appeared to post largely about video games in 2022, encouraging users to check out his YouTube channel, which featured dozens of short videos about popular Nintendo game Super Smash Bros. Before the account was taken down. By 2024, archived tweets show him resharing political content from other users. Allen repeatedly retweeted posts on X comparing Trump to Hitler, as well as posts advocating for nullifying that year's election results. That's 2024. In the wake of the attempted assassination of Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, Allen retweeted posts basically speculating that the attack could have been staged. It's ironic. Well, that last one's ironic because, well, I think he was posting. He was posting. People were speculating that his assassination attempt was staged. So, and then, you know, I think he repeated a post or he called Trump a traitor, a rapist, and a pedophile. So, and of course, you know, so I don't think it's really hard to isolate, you know, what his motive was. It was politically motivated. He was a consumer of mainstream Democrat political propaganda. And so you really can't say that he's like some weird nut job in the sense that, you know, his views express the viewpoint of a lot of Democrats. I mean, yeah, it's hard to deny that, isn't it? I mean, you know, you'd think. But, you know, take that for what it's worth. Let's see here. Okay. And so, yeah, so there you go. And let's see here. Oh, gosh. Let's see. Did I just read, you know, all my, all my, All my news things got repoted in this different way. Hang on a moment. Oh, yeah, I'm looking in the wrong folder, so apologize to you there. I got to get to the right folder for my sound clips. Let's see here. For a lot of people who say, well, you know, political violence is equal on both sides or whatever, right? No, it is predominantly on the left. And, you know, so people will cite studies that show, well, no, there's more political violence on the left, or it's relatively equal. And no, it's not. Let's see here. Oh, here is Bhatia Ungar Sargon. I believe she was on the Katie Pavlich show on News Nation, basically taking the three major studies that cite, you know, where the political motivations of political violence is, and basically, you know, and all three studies conclude that it's pretty much equal on both sides. And Bhatia Ungar Sargon basically debunks all three of the studies. So here we go.
Geraldo brought up this idea that the left and the right are equal when it comes to calls for violence or acts of violence. You have done an amazing job of digging through the data. And what did you find?
All right. So, Geraldo, see if you find this compelling.
Okay.
All right? So it seems to me that there are three main sources that you hear a lot from the mainstream media that allegedly prove that the problem we have right now with political violence is a both sides problem. There's the Cato Institute, there's the Prosecution Project out of the University of Cincinnati, and then there's the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now, these are all always shared by the likes of The Economist, The Wall Street Journal today shared Center for Strategic and International Studies. The problem is when you dig down into that data, it is so deeply flawed. Let me just give you a few examples, okay? The Prosecution Project, supposed to list all of the acts of political violence in America, does not list Charlie Kirk's assassination, does not list Trump's assassination attempts, does not list any George Floyd violence. 24 Americans lost their lives during those riots, not listed. But every white nationalist who's a drug dealer, that gets listed. So they list 33 white Aryans, Aryan Nation people, who had a meth lab. This is political violence because they happen to be white nationalists. All right, Cato does not list the 9/11 victims, does not list any George Floyd violence. Center for Strategic and International Studies, where does it get its data from? The ADL, highly partisan, and the Southern, which just was revealed to have allegedly been funding the very racists that they were supposed to be fighting. And finally, I just have to mention this, the Center for Strategic and International Studies has in its methodology section, it says all anti-Semitism is right wing. Mm-hmm. Any attacks on Jews or Jewish institutions, they reclassified it. If it was in the name of Palestinians, they reclassified it as ethno-nationalist. Mm-hmm. So by their definition, there's no such thing as left-wing anti-Semitism, which we all know is just nonsense. This is the data. It is flawed. Shame on the Wall Street Journal and shame on The Economist because they're giving a flawed view. And I totally agree with Katie. We can't. It would be so nice to say, kumbaya, we all share the problem. You cannot fix a problem if you are lying about what it is.
Yeah, so... So, yeah, so, you know, if you count any crime committed by a white supremacist as politically motivated, even if it's not politically motivated, if it's, you know, yeah, that'll up your right-wing political violence crime, even though if they're not politically motivated, they're just run-of-the-mill crimes, they just happen to involve white nationalists or Aryan Nation members. Yeah, that'll up the right-hand side. And then if you count all anti-Semitic crimes as right-wing, yeah, that'll definitely inflate the right-wing side of the conservative extreme, right-wing conservative extremist side, even if most of the anti-Semitic crimes are committed by far-left, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas people. Yeah, I totally get that. And so no. Or if you exclude all the more prominent left-wing violence, politically motivated violence like the George Floyd riots or the assassination of Donald Trump, the multiple assassination attempts on Donald Trump. Right. Though those aren't politically motivated at all. No. They just didn't like Trump because, you know, they're big Rosie O'Donnell fans, as the case may be. And then you know, I guess, what was it? There here are a couple other stories. What was it? Hakeem Jeffries just doubled down on his calls for maximum warfare against the GOP. Again, this is after Cole Thomas Allen's assassination attempt on Donald Trump. This is from Town Hall. Joseph Chalfant, April 27. Senate Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has come under fire after he decided to double down on his calls for maximum warfare, quote unquote, against Republicans just days after deranged leftists attempted to assassinate President Donald Trump and key figures of his administration. Let's see here. Maximum warfare everywhere, all the time, Jeffries reiterated when asked if he would tone down his rhetoric. Still, the violence against conservatives continued making headlines. Jeffries claimed that both at a press conference and on social media that it's actually Republicans who need to turn down the temperature. Yep. Quote, America will not be lectured about civility by far-right extremists in Congress, Jeffries said in a statement, particularly those who provide aid and comfort for hundreds of violent rioters who brutally beat police officers on January 6th. Yeah, remember, we just found out, I mean, it took like almost like 4 years for the FBI to admit that they had at least a couple dozen undercover informants in the J6 crowd. So let's see here. I think we have a quote here from Mr. Hakeem Jeffries.
As it relates to anything that has been said, certainly as it relates to the comment related to maximum warfare everywhere, all the time, in connection with the redistricting battle that Republicans launched, I stand by it. You can continue to criticize me for it. I don't give a damn about your criticism.
Yeah. So I think he's really in on it. And then for those who say that, well, Democrats aren't inciting violence. Let's see here. I think this is from a couple things. This is from End Wokeness. This is a supercut of various Democrats and progressive news pundits, you know, using kind of insightful language. You know, I'll let you be the judge.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be.
People need to start taking to the streets. This is a dictator.
You know, there needs to be unrest in the streets for as long as there's unrest in our lives.
Enemies of the state.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful.
Do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless.
When they go low, we kick.
How do you resist the temptation to run up and wring her neck?
Biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right up to the right.
I thought he should have punched him in the face. I said, even if you lost, he insulted your wife.
Yes.
He came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He said, well, what do you think I should have done? I said, I think you should have punched him in the face and then gotten out of the race. You would have been a hero.
I'd like to punch him in the face. I said, if we were in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
Punch some people in the face.
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump, and that's a fact.
Look, as his character is stabbed to death.
Where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him?
I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
A Missouri state senator is under investigation by the Secret Service after saying she hopes President Trump is assassinated.
I will go and take Trump out tonight.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
And sadly, the domestic enemies to our voting system and our honoring our Constitution are right at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
They're not going to stop before Election Day in November, and they're not going to stop after Election Day. And that should be, everyone should take note of that on both levels, that this isn't, they're not going to let up, and they should not.
If you think we're rallying now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah. So, are the Democrats inciting an assassination, as the various assassination attempts on Donald Trump? You can debate that, but flip it on the other side. Had Republicans and conservatives said all those things that we just played for you regarding Joe Biden and the and going out on the streets and not being peaceful and being disruptive, right? Would they be so sanguine now? Oh no, that's not incitement to assassination and political violence. No. In fact, they took Donald Trump's speech on January 6th of 2021 saying, you know, peacefully and respectfully, patriotically make your voices be heard, but fight like hell as an incitement to riot. So yeah, no, they wouldn't extend the same sympathy, but you know, in case, you know, that was a video, so maybe you don't recognize all the voices. Here is Carolyn Leavitt about a day or two after the assassination, where she calls out various elected Democrats by name and what they said that possibly incited Cole, Thomas, Allen, and various others to become violent based on their political motivations. Here we go.
It's not just the media, it is the entire Democrat Party has made their pitch to voters across the country that Donald Trump poses an existential threat to democracy, that he is a fascist, and that they compare him to Hitler. I mean, these are despicable statements that the American people have been consuming for years. And so many mentally perturbed individuals are led to believe these words are truth and then are inspired to act on it. I have a whole host of examples that we can share with you after. It is pages and pages of major Democrat Party elected officials saying, such as Rep. Hakeem Jeffries, just this month said, "We are in an era of maximum warfare everywhere all the time." Governor Josh Shapiro said, "Heads need to roll within the administration." Senator Alex Padilla said, "People are, quote, dying because of fear and terror caused by the Trump administration." Senator Elizabeth Warren, "President Trump is making the country look like a, quote, fascist state." Senator Adam Schiff saying President Trump using a dictator playbook. Senator Ed Markey calling President Trump a dictator, saying that this administration's actions are authoritarianism on steroids. Governor J.B. Pritzker, "Never before in my life have I called for mass protest disruptions. These Republicans cannot know a moment of peace." You have Rep. Presley saying, "We'll see you in the streets." Rep. Monica McIver, a Democrat representative on Capitol Hill, "We will not take this shit from Donald Trump. He thinks he's a dictator. We are at war." These are Democrat elected officials calling for war against the President of the United States and his supporters. I could go on and on, but again, when you have people in positions of power that are saying things like this every single day for years, you are inspiring violence by people who are already mentally ill. And that's what we've seen against this president for far too long.
Yeah. So now you might say that the quotes that that Carolyn Leavitt has, you know, recited are just the normal hyperbole of our political dialogue. Okay. Well, someone apparently took all that political hyperbole and took it seriously. You know, Cole Thomas Allen in his manifesto, you know, absorbed all that rhetoric and took it to heart and did something about it. You know, Trump is Hitler. Okay, I'm going to go take down Hitler by his own manifesto. It's like, yo, I've always wanted to do something about it. I guess I'm going to do something about it right now. Compare it to the previous 4 years of Joe Biden. Now, I'm sure Republicans and conservatives like myself probably did not say nice things about Joe Biden or the Joe Biden administration. I will definitely cop to that. But I don't think you have many Republicans or conservative pundits of any prominence calling for actual violence against the Biden regime or whatever, or the Kamala Harris regime, right? And how do I know? And, you know, in terms of proof is in the pudding, were there any assassination attempts on Joe Biden during his 4 years in office, or any of his cabinet officials? No. So there you go. Oh, I'm sure there's the low level, you know, the Secret Service catches this guy making threats online. But, you know, beyond that, you know, like the same for Trump, but, you know, probably a lot more, but nothing along the lines of Butler, Pennsylvania, or Thomas Routh in Florida, or, you know, Cole Thomas Allen. So anyways, let's see here. Oh, and, you know, to be honest with you, I think there are a lot of progressives who are disappointed that Cole Cole Thomas Allen failed. Just point blank, right? And as evidence of this, here is from Zero Hedge, but this is reported in multiple places. April 27, Democrat-owned brewery complains about failed Trump assassination attempt with twisted promise to customers. The Minocqua Brewing Company, a craft brewer in Minocqua, Wisconsin, run by Democrat activists, is facing fierce blowback after its social media account appeared to mock a recent assassination attempt on President Donald Trump and reiterated an earlier pledge to offer free beer on the day of his death. The company, owned by Kirk Bangstad, who ran as a Democrat nominee for Wisconsin's 34th Assembly District in 2020 and founded the anti-Republican Super PAC, posted on social media shortly after news of the latest attempt on the president, quote, "We almost got pound sign free beer day. And the post read, according to the screenshot circulated online, quote, "Either a brother or sister in the resistance needs to work on their marksmanship, or he faked another assassination to get a positive news cycle we'll never know," unquote. Oh, quote, "Regardless, we stand at the ready to pour free beer the day it happens," the post added. The brewery had previously promised free beer all day long the day he dies, in reference to Trump. The brewery also sells merchandise tied to the pledge, including t-shirts that read, quote, "I wish it was free beer day," and markets itself as blending craft beer with radical progressive activism. Spokesman for the Wisconsin Democrat Party condemned the post, quote, "This rhetoric is completely unacceptable and should be retracted immediately," Phil Schulman told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. "We're not afraid to call this sort of inappropriate behavior, no matter where it comes from. Our GOP colleagues should learn to do the same." Well, I don't know. Has anybody, you know, offered to celebrate the death of Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, or Joe Biden? When Jimmy Carter died, were there any conservatives or Republicans of any level of prominence beyond just wackadoodle that was sitting here going, "I'm so glad Jimmy Carter's dead. I hope he burns in hell"? I doubt it, but, you know, don't be wrong. In a nation of 300 plus million people, there's probably one person, at least one or two people you can find that was probably expressing glee that Jimmy Carter died. But not enough that, you know, the media was looking for. But what motivates people to do this, right? Because I think people pointed out that this Cole Thomas Alexander was a graduate of Caltech and got his master's degree in computer science at Cal State Dominguez Hills. Why would someone who is so educated be so crazy? And this article from the dailycaller.com might provide some insight. Highly educated people like would-be Trump assassin more likely to favor political violence. This is by Jaron Crusan, education reporter for Daily Caller, April 27. People with graduate degrees, like the man who allegedly tried to kill President Donald Trump and his cabinet members on Saturday, are more likely to support political violence, polling shows. A 2025 report by the Skeptic Research Center found that people who hold graduate degrees are twice as likely to believe that violence is often necessary to create social change, compared to those who have completed lower-level college degrees or opted out of higher education altogether. Cole Allen, who allegedly opened fire at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday with a stated intention to kill members of the Trump administration, reportedly obtained a master's degree in computer science from California State University, Dominguez Hills. I bet you they're real proud of their alum. Anyways, among those who hold high school diploma or less, only 23% believe that political violence can be justified, according to the poll. About 20% of individuals who have completed some college or obtained an associate's degree believe the same. The figure is slightly higher for those who hold a bachelor's degree, with 26% agreeing with the statement. However, among master's degree candidates, a whopping 40% say violence should be justified to enact social change. Quote, "I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes," Allen reportedly wrote in a manifesto sent to family members just minutes before the shooting. In a statement released following the shooting, Cal State University Dominguez Hills said that a student by the name of Cole Allen did graduate from the university with a master's degree in 2025, but added it cannot confirm if this person is the same suspect identified in the assassination plot. Yeah, I guess you got to be able to go there. But, oh, poor guy. But anyway, yeah, I mean, the thing is, how did Cal, I don't know about Cal State Dominguez Hills, but Caltech is a relatively elite college. You have to be, you know, kind of creme de la creme to get in. And everyone wondering how he got in there. And the thing is, I'm speculating, so, you know, but he's half black. So I'm thinking he was an affirmative action. There's a good chance he was an affirmative action admittee, as the case may be. Probably felt a little inferiority complex if he didn't do as well as his non-affirmative action classmates. But that's speculation. I don't know what his grades are. I haven't seen his transcript. So maybe he was a total genius. But you know what? For someone with a computer science degree from Caltech and then a master's degree from Cal State Dominguez Hills, you'd think he'd be working a more higher paying job than just tutoring high school applicants. But yeah, whatever. But could be wrong. Let's see here. This is from Jonathan Turley. A nation divided, the chilling embrace of political violence in the U.S. We are seeing an increasing support for violent action across social media, including those lamenting that recent presidential assassination was not successful. Conservative sites have been featuring teachers and others who are upset that the recent effort failed, including one who now has lost her job. The current violence and rhetoric has been building for years as our leaders feel rage in our nation. One poll by the University of Virginia Center for Politics found that 52% of Biden supporters say Republicans are now a threat to American life, while 47% of Trump's supporters say the same about Democrats. Among Biden supporters, 41% believe violence is justified to stop Republicans from achieving their goals. An almost identical percentage, 38% of Trump supporters embrace violence to stop Democrats. The support for political violence is growing. One prior poll shows a quarter of Americans supporting political violence. An earlier survey by the Baker Center for Georgetown University also captured a growing divide amongst Americans on this 250th anniversary of our revolution. Public distrust of the media, democracy, and each other appears to be growing as one out of seven Americans now embraces political violence. That survey also continued showed the continuing drop of support in the media. As mainstream media continues to show the same bias in advocacy journalism that has been alienating media citizens, roughly half, 49% of the public, has little or no confidence in the press. Roughly the same percentage believe that the press favors Democrats in its coverage. The percentage with greater confidence in media is now just 18%. That sounds about right. You know, the thing is, what I suspect is this is consistent with what I would think is what would be going on in a color revolution that the CIA would sponsor in some third world country. You foment violence and political extremism and dysfunction in society, and then which fosters social unrest and foment and civil war, and then people take over. And here's another interesting article regarding the assassination attempt. This is from, let's see here, notthebee.com. And basically it quotes Andy Ogles, who is an elected Republican member of Congress, who was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And, you know, so he was there. And he claims that while he was, I assume, under the table, right, when the first shots rang out, everyone's like hiding underneath the tables. One of the other journalists that was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner said, "I hope that Trump gets assassinated." Do I have the clip here? Yes, here is the clip from Andy Ogles after the fact.
There was a reporter, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna say it. There was a reporter in the room who was under a table, and when the shots went off and everybody's hiding, she said, "I hope they killed the orange MF." That was a journalist in the room who was hoping that when she stood up, the president of the United States would be dead. So I'm coming to a public venue where I know it might be hostile to expose myself to an honest dialogue, an open dialogue. And if you ask me a question and I don't have an answer, I will get you something in writing or we can talk on the phone. But when you have members of the press openly enticing, hoping, talking about killing the chief executive officer of this country. Again, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, I don't care. That's a problem.
I'm sorry, what did she say?
I hope they killed the orange MF.
So yeah, you have at least one journalist that was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner who herself might have been in danger of being killed. Not as the intended target, but as a bystander or collateral damage. While under potential threat of said collateral damage and hostile gunfire, under the table, quietly rooting for Donald Trump to be dead. And again, this is not some fringe wackadoodle in the middle of nowhere. This was a guest, a journalist at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So you have to assume that she was of some level of intelligence, accomplishment, achievement to actually get a job as a White House correspondent journalist or whatever, or be adjacent to said White House correspondent journalist to actually get an invite to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and dress up for the nerd prom, as the case may be. But what can you say, right? It's a, why is our political dialogue seemingly becoming more polarized? I think since the end of the Cold War, the prospect of actual end of our existence in the United States has gone, right? I mean, you know, yes, there are theoretically, you could theoretically still be ended by nuclear war, but there is no unifying ideology to end us. And so maybe, you know, it's part of the human condition to seek an enemy, right? And if the Soviet Union and communists are no longer the enemy, maybe we make it ourselves, as the case may be. But yeah, speaking of politics, I think these are one of those things where polling can be all over the map kind of thing. So you always try to take things with a grain of salt. The midterm elections, right? Generally speaking, you know, if the Democrats are going to retake the House, win a majority of the House of Representatives, the conventional wisdom is you look at the generic congressional poll. Are you going to vote for, you know, are you voting for a Democrat or are you voting for a Republican? You know, nationwide, right? That's usually the barometer that people use to predict who's going to take control of the House in the next election. And the conventional wisdom is that Democrats need to lead by at least 4 or 5 points in the congressional preference poll to take control of the House. If they lead by less than that, or the Republicans lead, then, you know, the Republicans will take control of the House. And that's a function of a couple things, I think. Number one, because the Constitution guarantees, like, really small, sparsely populated states, at least one member in the House of Representatives. That tends to favor the Republicans, or because, you know, they tend to be more popular in conservative rural states. And of course, the other thing is Democrats being more of an urban party, they tend to be more concentrated in compact districts. So their districts tend to be more heavily Democrat than Republican districts tend to be more heavily Republican, right? They're just more compact. So you can't just split it. You can't just split it like they tried to do in Virginia, where they tried to split the northern, you know, Arlington, Virginia into 8 million little pieces, right? It's harder to do that, right? So one is the Harvard-Harris poll, which basically taken the this past week or the week before, basically shows amongst the congressional generic ballot poll tied Republicans and Democrats. So that would mean that the Republicans hold, right? Now, on the other hand, Emerson College, which also is a respectable pollster, these are both pretty respectable. They're not like Reuters, Ipsos, or Marist, or you know, YouGov, NORC. Those are the crap pollsters. But Harvard Harris is decent. Emerson's pretty decent too. But Emerson actually has taking this poll roughly around the same time Harvard Harris did their poll, generic congressional ballot preference. Emerson had the Democrats at plus 10, which, again, if it holds to the conventional wisdom, the Democrats would take it. Now, you have two polls taken at the same time. You'd think that they use roughly the same methodology that pollsters all are supposed to use. You know, take that for granted. So one shows dead even, and the Republicans hold. The other shows plus 10, and, you know, the Democrats win. So what do you make of it? I just figure, you know, it's still very early. And according to general statistical conventional wisdom, right? When you take a poll, when you usually it's at a 95% confidence interval, right? Which, what does that mean? That means that once every 20 times, you're going to get a poll that's completely crap. So one of them could be taking a crap poll, you know, or, you know, it's early, it's still relatively early. And, you know, again, and because the economy, you know, the economy not may not be doing as well as people would hope because of the Iran war and high gas prices and all that, yada, yada, yada. Who knows? But so, yeah, so take that with a grain of salt. Oh, by the way, but here's an interesting little tidbit. Apparently, Donald Trump is doing better amongst black voters than people would seem to believe. This is Harry Enten amongst black voters.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing right now in the numbers is President Trump and the Republican Party are chipping away at the long-term advantage that Democrats have had with black voters, with African Americans. You can see it right here. Look, Trump's approval among African Americans at this point in term one, he was at 12%. You know, he's been losing ground with a lot of people. He's gaining ground with African Americans. He's up to 16% at this point. And you say, this isn't that big of a shift. But I will tell you, Republicans absolutely love this shift that's going on because Democrats have had such a long-term advantage. The fact that he's actually gaining ground versus where he was in term number one, this has major implications for elections down the line because Democrats, especially in a lot of these tight races, you talk about places like Georgia, right down in the South, you see this type of movement for Trump actually gaining ground. This could have major ramifications and help put Republicans over the top in a number of southern places in the midterm elections.
But do you see this as part of a bigger trend?
I see this as absolutely part of a bigger trend. Donald Trump's Republican Party is absolutely gaining ground, not just him gaining in terms of his approval rating, but look at the party ID margin, Kate, mm-hmm. because this to me was absolutely stunning. Look at this party ID margin among African Americans. At this point in Trump term number one, Democrats had a 63-point advantage. That has absolutely fallen. Look at where it is now. A double-digit shift away. Democrats, of course, still have the advantage, but it's a 12-point shift to the Republican Party. And I look back through Gallup's records. They sent me their records. And this, in fact, lead that Democrats have is actually smaller than any lead from 2006 to 2021. So Democrats are leading. But again, we're talking about chipping away. Republicans are chipping away at this long-term advantage that Democrats have had among African Americans. We see it in terms of Trump's approval rating, and we even see it to a wider degree among the party ID margin, where all of a sudden there are a number of African Americans who are walking away from the Democratic Party and a number of them who are walking into the Republican tent.
That is very interesting, looking at that past Gallup information.
Yeah.
What does this mean for the race for control in Congress?
Okay, so you see this right here. You see this 51-point advantage that Democrats have, significantly less than you see that 63-point advantage. And what we will note was back in 2024, right, Donald Trump put in a historically strong performance among African Americans. Democrats performed the worst in a generation. Have they gained any of that coalition back from where they fell down to in 2024? But take a look here. Okay. Choice for election among African Americans. Kamala Harris was leading amongst that group in the pre-election polling by 63 points. Are Democrats gaining back any of that ground? Uh-uh. It's a 62-point advantage now. Republicans are holding on to the gains that they made among African Americans in 2024. Republicans are gaining among African Americans. They are chipping away at that long-term advantage. The Donald Trump-led Republican Party is making gains among African Americans that we simply put have not seen the Republican Party make in a generation.
Yeah, that's that'll be interesting. Now, if the economy goes south or, you know, there's a war that goes out of control, all bets are off, right? But at this point, you know, Hispanic or Latino voters are pretty much now a swing group. They're pretty much close to break even. White working class, blue collar voters are very, very Republican. People with whites with college degrees are still relatively even, but I think that's where the Democrats have really made their gains. Of course, white voters who have graduate degrees and higher, PhDs especially, they are now the Democrats' strongest group. Of course, you know, that's ironically the group that believes political violence is the most justified. So I don't know if there's any I don't know if there's any correlation with that. But anyways, so yeah. So I mean, it would be ironic if black voters became less monolithically Democrat and became a little bit more Republican. Given how close things are now, even a small swing in one of the groups could throw a lot of elections. And of course, you know, maybe all that redistricting might come back to backfire on the Republicans if blacks become the, if the blacks return to the GOP prior to the Great Depression, as the case may be. But yeah, who knows? Time for the California update. And let's see here. Oh, this is from the California Post, April 28th, Josh Cohn. California's high-speed rail now the worst project in history as insiders reveal unbelievable new cost. Calls are growing for California's high-speed rail to be abandoned completely after revelations the estimated cost of completing Gavin Newsom's fantasy train project has ballooned to a staggering $231 billion. The latest cost revisions for the project revealed during a Senate Transportation Committee meeting left lawmakers fuming after the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst's Office flagged numerous concerns. Senator Tony Strickland, vice chair of the STC, said that California High-Speed Rail Authority's plan continues to obscure true costs, and now he's calling for the entire project to be scrapped. This is despite the project having already burned through a cool $14 billion in taxpayers' cash, mostly on land acquisition and construction in the Central Valley. Quote, I've been saying this for years now, but this is the most wasteful government project in probably the world history, Strickland told the Post. Quote, it goes from $33 billion projected estimate to the voters to go from LA to San Francisco, and now it's $231 billion and climbing. My dad always taught me at an early age, when you dig a hole for yourself, the best way out of the hole is to stop digging. Yeah. So for all of those geniuses who think that, well, we should have California should have high-speed rail, you're right. You know, the thing is, originally, when it was proposed in 2008, it was cost about $33 billion. It was supposed to be done by 2020. It was supposed to go from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Here we are now in 2026. Not a single mile of track has been laid. We spent $14 billion so far, and there's no prospect of this thing going from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And now the estimated cost is $231 billion. Now, the last time someone asked the geniuses at the genius DEI hires at the California High-Speed Rail Authority, how much is this thing going to cost? They quoted $126 billion. So it was $126 billion. Now it's $231 billion and climbing. Where are you going to get the money from, right? Now, currently, California High-Speed Rail is being funded by revenue from California's cap and trade tax to the tune of $1 billion a year. You do the math. Now, even at the ridiculously previously crack-smoking estimate of only $126 billion, you spend up $1 billion a year. How long is it going to take to build it? 126 years. Now it's $231 billion. So $1 billion a year divided by $231 billion to finish it, divided by $1 billion a year the spending. How long does it take? Yeah, 231 years. In fact, America might be celebrating its 500th anniversary, should it last that long, before the California High-Speed Rail is actually finished. Yet, if you ask of the 8 Democrat candidates who are running for governor of the state of California, 5 of the 8 say, oh no, we should keep funding it. We should keep funding it. Because why? There's no actual source of actual funding for it that would complete it. You know, and even the Bakersfield to Merced, or I think it's now like a suburb of Bakersfield to a suburb of Merced. It's like, oh yeah, because there are a lot of people who want to go from Bakersfield to Merced that would justify high-speed rail that can't drive a car, right? Yeah, I don't think that thing is going to be done until like maybe sometime in the 2030s, even if, you know, it's crack-smokingly optimistic, because this is the cheapest part segment of the high-speed rail, because that's not going through mountains and, you know, valleys and through, you know, highly populated areas that people have land that they don't want, you know, they don't want a high-speed rail going through the land. They don't want to be kicked off their property, but hey, you know. Oh, speaking of which, this is from the Orange County Register, more than $2 million seized from Pasadena Clinic accused of Medicare fraud. Let's see here. Published on April 28th, and there's no byline. No, let's see. Federal prosecutors are authorized to seize more than $2 million from a Pasadena-based wound care clinic accused of defrauding Medicare for reimbursement for skin graft substitutes and skin grafts that were never performed, officials said Tuesday. Now, see, this is the thing. If it was just this one thing, $2 million out of the however many tens of billions of dollars that the state of California spends on healthcare, which is its biggest line item in terms of, I think it's like, it used to be education, but now it's like, you know, healthcare costs, like, you know, Medi-Cal and the various subsidiary programs, right? It is now the biggest cost item on the California state budget, right? It was just this. No big deal. Who cares? $2 million. You know, it's like, yeah, that's bad. We'll go after them, right? But no, we have, we've had Nick Shirley and Dr. Oz, you know, exposing, cut 10, 20 million here, 10 million here, million here, million here. It adds up to real money. And, you know, it's ridiculously expensive. You know, I mean, how much of whatever California spends on Medi-Cal is actually fraud? We don't know. For all we know, it could be like tens of billions of dollars. It could be maybe hundreds of billions of dollars for all we know. So, you know, and the weird thing is, I think the one of the guys who is the for governor, Xavier Becerra, said, "Well, I'm the only one on the stage who's actually run a healthcare department." It's like, yeah, he was Joe Biden's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Guess what? When all this fraud was going on, who was head of the Federal Health and Human Services Department? Xavier Becerra, right? So when California and Minnesota and potentially other blue states were ripping off the federal government to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, maybe even hundreds of billions, over $100 billion a year, right? Who was the guy in charge? Xavier Becerra. So yeah, let's make him governor of California because he was so good at rooting out and sniffing out and preventing fraud. Let's put him in charge of the entire state. Yeah, that's a good, or, you know, and then maybe he can make sure that there's no waste and fraud in the construction of California high-speed rail. Good thing about California high-speed rail is, like, it's only going to get $1 billion a year, not the tens of billions of dollars a year of fraudulent money various healthcare programs in California are receiving from the federal government or spending. So, yeah, unless, of course, they elect a Democrat again as president, then maybe they'll spend more crack-smokingly wasteful money in the on the state. Let's see here. For those of you who are upset about electricity prices, this is an interesting little take. This is from the AmericanThinker.com by J. Garvin Walsh. San Diego's energy problem, SDGE, which is San Diego Gas and Electric, absorbs the blame for everything wrong with California's energy policy is the subhead. There's a ritual in San Diego households. Each month, SDGE bill arrives and toll registers sharply because San Diego carries the highest residential electricity rates in the nation. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, SDG&E customers pay nearly 46 cents per kilowatt hour, roughly 70% above the national average, a rate that exceeds even Hawaii. And the company, whose name is on the envelope, absorbs the blame for everything wrong with California's energy policy. Now, he points out to two things. Number one, because of San Diego's unique geography, you have to build power lines over mountains, valleys, ridges, or whatever. And, you know, wildfire mitigation is extremely expensive, right? But the other thing that makes it extremely expensive is the renewable energy portfolio, right? So by requiring a certain amount of electricity to be generated by wind and solar, you got to build these wind and solar facilities in remote areas that have a lot of land, and then you have to transmit that electricity through transmission lines back to the populated areas of the city of San Diego. And those transmission lines run through, well, wildfire, brush fire risks and stuff like that. And of course, renewable wind and solar are very, very, very expensive to maintain because you have to also maintain baseload power when the wind don't blow and the sun don't shine. So that's why it costs so much more. But anyways, I am getting close to the end of our show, so let's see here. I will join you again in the future. This has been the Danger Zone Second Hour, aka the Buzz the Tower podcast. And everyone have a great weekend.